This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 21st of February, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Laura Bogado.
The offer that the Iranians need to make is to suspend activity that could lead to the enrichment of nuclear material that could be used in creating a bomb.
Tensions between the U.S. and Iran increase, as a new report indicates Iran has not suspended its nuclear program. The United Nations urges the Philippine government to reevaluate its counterinsurgency campaign in a bid to stop extrajudicial killings.
Where intimidation doesn't seem to work, the approach escalates into execution. This is a grave and serious problem.
And we'll hear a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal on the anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Italy's Prime Minister Romano Prodi resigned today shortly after some of his government's key foreign policy measures failed to secure the approval of the Italian Senate. Among the measures that failed to pass, funding for the Italian operation in Afghanistan. In addition to Rome's participation in the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, many Italians have been galvanized against militarization domestically by unpopular plans to expand a U.S. base in the northern Italian city of Vicenza. The Italian president is now responsible for deciding how to replace the prime minister. Denmark today announced that it will completely withdraw its troops from Iraq by August. Most Danish troops are with the British forces in southern Iraq, and those British forces will also begin to withdraw soon. British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced the troop reduction today in Parliament. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Tony Blair was absent during the last parliamentary debate on Iraq. The announcement today would normally be made by the Defence Minister, but today it was the Prime Minister.
The actual reduction in forces will be from the present 7,100 down 40,000 at the time of the conflict to roughly 5,500. With the exception of forces which will remain at Basra Palace, the British forces will be in a support role. Over time, and depending naturally on progress and the capability of the Iraqi security forces, we will be able to draw down further, possibly to below 5,000 once the Basra Palace site has been transferred to the Iraqis in late summer.
Troop withdrawal by one of the US's biggest military allies flies in the face of Bush's 21,500 troop surge. But Britain's controversial role in Iraq has utterly dominated Tony Blair's final term in office. Due to step down this summer, critics say he'd always wanted to announce withdrawals before then, an attempt, they say, to protect his legacy and try to improve his low popularity ratings over the whole issue. 132 British military personnel have died in Iraq since the US-led invasion in 2003. There's no official death toll kept on Iraqi deaths. The Prime Minister today refused calls for an inquiry into the failings of his Iraq policy. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Colombia has stepped up efforts to secure some $12 billion in funding to continue Plan Colombia, a mostly military intervention in the more than four-decade-long civil conflict in the South American country. This comes as Colombia is in the midst of one of the worst political scandals in its recent history, in which Colombian government officials are being linked directly to right-wing paramilitaries. The scandal has implicated key political figures and on Monday led to the resignation of Colombia's foreign minister. Five senators were arrested last week. Back in this country, the Bush administration continues to support Plan Colombia, but campaigners want Congress to examine Colombia's human rights record before the vote to approve funding. Nan McCurdy has more from the Capitol Steps.
According to the Latin American Working Group, the U.S. has provided more than $4 billion in aid to Colombia since 2000, and 80% has gone to the military. Reports of extrajudicial executions by members of the Colombian military are commonplace, as well as attacks against human rights defenders who denounce abuses. Renata Rendon is advocacy director with Amnesty International USA.
Despite ongoing reports of human rights violations committed by the military, ongoing reports of military-paramilitary collaboration, and the infiltration of the Colombian state by paramilitaries, a U.S.-designated international terrorist organization, the United States continues to provide billions of dollars in military aid to Colombia.
The coalition wants hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. military aid to Colombia to be redirected to social and economic programs and to support the establishment and the protection of the rule of law. Today marks the second anniversary of a massacre of 8 members of the Colombian peace community. No arrests have been made in that case, despite assurances from the Colombian government. Critics say the Bush administration's 2008 proposed aid to Colombia shows they are not willing to adopt a new approach, despite the poor results of Plan Colombia up till now. The onus is now on Congress to determine how money is directed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
And finally, White House correspondent Helen Thomas will no longer be able to sit in the chair she has occupied for years in the front and center of the White House press room. Helen Thomas has been in the White House press corps for 46 years, asking questions since the administration of John F. Kennedy. During the current administration, Thomas has consistently brought up the invasion and occupation of Iraq. An unnamed cable news channel will occupy the seat of the 86-year-old correspondent when remodeling is complete on the White House briefing room. Thomas says she'll still be at the briefings to ask questions. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A United Nations official investigating a spate of political killings in the Philippines said today that he was convinced that many of the murders were committed by the military, which he criticized for being in, quote, a state of almost total denial, unquote. Philip Alston, UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Executions, urged the government to reevaluate its counterinsurgency campaign because some of its aspects tend to abet the killings. FSRN's Girly Linao reports from Manila.
Philip Alston, the UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Executions, did not mince words as he expressed alarm over the killings of hundreds of political activists in the Philippines at the end of a 10-day mission. With security officials insisting that leftist groups were just exaggerating the extent of the problem by padding the number of victims, Alston said the numbers game was unproductive.
Is it 25? Is it 100? Is it 800? Is it many more? I don't have a figure, but I'm certain that the number is high enough to be distressing. Even more importantly, numbers are not what count in this matter. The impact of even a limited number of killings of the type alleged is corrosive in many ways. It intimidates vast numbers of civil society actors. It sends a message of vulnerability to everyone, except the most well-connected, and it severely undermines the political discourse, which is central to a resolution of the problems confronting this country.
Karapatan, a local human rights group, says the number of extrajudicial killings has reached more than 800 since 2001. Most of the victims were leftist activists, human rights workers, labor leaders, and journalists. Karapatan has a list of victims, but authorities contend that some of the names on the list are not actually victims of politically motivated killings. Alston did not say if the UN would take steps to verify the numbers. Leftist groups have blamed the military for most of the killings, which they say are part of President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo's campaign against the 38-year-old communist insurgency. Marihelau Enriquez is the Secretary General of Karapatan.
Time and again, we have been saying that these killings are going on primarily because it is committed by state security forces and that there is a national policy, no, to commit this in the effort under the aegis of the War on Terror and the total war against the insurgency. No, with the Arroyo government hell-bent on exterminating all the insurgents during its time.
Alston said the armed forces of the Philippines, or the AFP, must first acknowledge that there is a problem for any effort to stop the killings to move forward.
The AFP remains in a state of almost total denial. It's in denial of its need to respond effectively and authentically to the significant number of killings, which in my view have been convincingly attributed to them. The President needs to persuade the military that its reputation and effectiveness will be considerably enhanced rather than undermined if they acknowledge the facts and take genuine steps to investigate.
Before leaving Manila today, Alston urged Arroyo to review the military's counterinsurgency campaign, which he says has problematic aspects. The UN office in Manila said it would continue to work with the Philippine government to help stop the violence.
the way in which certain strategies are currently formulated, and more importantly being pursued in particular areas, is very conducive to extrajudicial executions. In some areas, an appeal to hearts and minds is combined with an attempt to vilify left-leaning organizations and to intimidate the leaders of such organizations. In such instances, where intimidation doesn't seem to work, the approach escalates into execution. This is a grave and serious problem, and one which I intend to examine in detail in my final report.
Alston said it would take him 3 months to complete his report and submit it to the UN Human Rights Commission. Evangeline Hernandez, whose 22-year-old daughter was shot dead by soldiers while on a human rights fact-finding mission in 2002, is looking forward to Alston's report and hopes his strong words would be a wake-up call for the Arroyo government. She said she was happy that more people would finally know about what has been happening in the Philippines and hope that her daughter's death under the hands of the military would not be in vain.
Pero nanginayang talaga ako. Kasi yung 22 years old, hindi pa yung sapat para sa sama.
I really feel bad because 22 years was not enough for us. I really miss my daughter. 22 years old, that's not enough. She could have been married by now, have children. I could have had grandchildren. But that's no longer possible.
Asawa na siya ngayon. Sana meron na siyang anak. Meron na sana akong apo. Eh wala. Kasi nga, naudlot.
The Philippine government said it would study Alston's recommendation as it again vowed to do its best to resolve the killings. It also reiterated a call for witnesses to step forward to prosecute the guilty. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao in Manila.
Tensions between the U.S. and Iran have intensified. The International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to report that Iran has not suspended its nuclear program despite a United Nations-imposed deadline. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has said Iran will continue to develop its nuclear program. Iran's Islamic Student News Agency quoted Ahmadinejad as saying 10 years of focus on nuclear energy and technology will move Iran, quote, some 50 years ahead and progress in this field, and I think it's worth the effort, he said. Ahmadinejad's statement comes as the United Nations imposed deadline demands Iran suspend its nuclear enrichment program by the end of this week. The Global Nuclear Watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, will release a status report on Iran's nuclear program Thursday. It is expected to say Iran has not suspended its program, but expanded it. The White House insists that Iran must forego any progress in making a nuclear bomb. White House spokesperson Tony Snow.
The offer that the Iranians need to make is to suspend activity that could lead to the enrichment of nuclear material that could be used in creating a bomb.
The IAEA report will be given to the United Nations Security Council, where a debate for additional sanctions could ensue. More sanctions will likely involve lengthy negotiations at the UN. The United States will likely push for more, but China and Russia can be resistant to punishing Iran. The last round of sanctions in December imposed financial freezes and travel restrictions on Iran's leaders. David Albright, president of the Institute of Science and International Security, says the targeted sanctions seem to be working.
It's a viable strategy. You just have these draconian sanctions dropped on a country that lead to immense suffering by the average person. This is a kind of a calibrated increase that is really aimed at making the leadership or the influential people think twice about what they're doing.
Ahmadinejad is not the sole decision maker in Iran. The Grand Ayatollahs have final say. And top Iranian negotiator Ali Larijani seemed to soften his stance. In a last-ditch meeting Tuesday with the IAEA, he maintains Iran's right to enrich uranium for energy, but he insisted that Iran won't develop a bomb. He said Iran is open to keeping enrichment levels at 4 to 5%, far below the 20% necessary for a nuclear weapon. Larijani also said Iran will give up their nuclear program if the U.S. gives up theirs, an unlikely scenario. But the IAEA report will likely say Iran is moving their centrifuges underground, out of sight of inspectors and the international community. David Eisenberg, senior analyst at the British American Security Information Council, says the last round of sanctions were supposed to signal a last chance for Iran, and they failed to comply again. He foresees a stalemate.
A lot of people, United States and elsewhere, people are concerned about Iran's nuclear program, were saying beforehand that this deadline is it. We're through playing games. We've given you every chance, and after this, no more diplomacy, no more negotiation, no more bargaining. You either comply or else. And I'm saying that even some of the states who said that still believe that there's continuing room in time for negotiation, diplomacy, bargaining, and even as they said, or else, they didn't really mean it.
The United States won't make a formal response or plan of action until after the IAEA report is released. But the U.S. has intensified relations with Iran over their involvement in Iraq. Last week, a second aircraft carrier arrived in the Persian Gulf, and the U.S. has accused Iran of contributing to violence in Iraq. The U.S. will likely use the more public arena, the United Nations, to oppose Iran as well, and they'll try to get the support of the international community. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As we mentioned in the headlines, British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced that as many as 1,600 British troops would be withdrawn from southern Iraq, even as U.S. troop levels are increased in the center of the country. But the new security sweeps, which have failed to prevent bombings and attacks and continue to kill dozens each day, have left few Iraqis convinced that the new security plan will make them safer. Salam Talib and Hiba Dawood have this report.
A car bomb in Karbala, 2 hours south of Baghdad, killed at least 47 today as the raids continued in the capital. Wajdan Adib is an Iraqi human rights activist. She is skeptical that U.S. troops will stay long enough to prevent the militiamen, insurgents, and criminals that have taken over some Baghdad neighborhoods from returning.
Before they started the security plan, they announced it. They announced the areas. They announced what they want to do. So all the bad people just left these areas, went somewhere else and hid somewhere else, or traveled outside the country, someone to Iran, someone to Syria, someone to Saudi Arabia, and waiting for this thing to finish, and then they turn them back. Who's left behind? Basically, the innocent people. So the raids and the arrests and detention and all this is happening mostly against innocent people, not the real criminals.
Areas just outside Baghdad also remain outside government's control. Al-Hamdani is an Iraqi journalist living in Baghdad. He says that while trying to continue work on a story about ethnic cleansing in the suburb of Abu Ghraib, he was briefly taken prisoner by insurgents. Al-Hamdani's captors, whom he described as disaffected young men, only let him go after a local cleric vouched for him.
دول المجرمين اللي هم تعرف هم دول معظمهم مو عراقيين في قيادتهم وافرادهم عراقيين.
These people are mostly criminals and most of their leaders are not Iraqis. The members are Iraqis who are paid. I was standing there with 15 people around me. Most of them were kids and spoke to me scornfully and asked, "Are you Sunni or Shiite?" I said, "I am Sunni. God has given me a new life." It was a disaster. You look at them and you feel they are ready to cook your flesh and eat it.
In another potential blow to the public faith Baghdad's security efforts, today Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki dismissed an Iraqi government official who had ordered a rape investigation. The alleged victim says Iraqi police assaulted her after a raid on her house by police who were looking for her husband. The dismissal comes a day after Maliki said that the allegation would be investigated. The Prime Minister has been under pressure from Sunni lawmakers who claim the rape was a sectarian attack. I'm Hiba Dawood with Salam Talib for FSRN.
For more than three decades, removing people with severe disabilities from the nation's institutions has been one of the disability rights movement's main priorities. That's why the organization Protection and Advocacy has filed a class action lawsuit against the city and county of San Francisco on behalf of more than 1,000 current, former, and potential residents of Laguna Honda Hospital, which it owns and operates. The plaintiffs charged the city with forcing them to live in the largest nursing home in the country because they say it's failed to give them decent housing and support services so they can live independently in the community. Instead, the city is rebuilding the 1,200-bed facility. David Mandel files this report from San Francisco.
Laguna Honda Hospital's main structure was built in 1867. Isolated from the rest of San Francisco, its corridors are long, bleak, and cold. Roughly 30 people live in each of its dormitory-style wards. Many of Laguna Honda's more than 1,000 residents are there because they've become disabled from traumatic brain injuries. That's what happened to Mark Chambers after being brutally assaulted 7 years ago. The 47-year-old former computer programmer is a paraplegic. The lead plaintiff in the lawsuit also has limited use of his hands, a speech impediment, and a cognitive impairment. Despite his many disabilities, Chambers says there's no reason for him to live at Laguna Honda. He says he would be able to live and work independently in the community if San Francisco provided him with appropriate housing and support services.
So, not possible.
You want a place out there?
Yeah, but nothing.
But there's no place for you.
Yeah.
You don't want to stay here the rest of your life?
Nuh-uh. Home.
Home?
Yes.
You want your own home?
Yes.
And you want to live independently?
Yes.
A city commission report issued last year found that about one of every 700 San Franciscans lives at Laguna Honda. Herb Levine is director of the Independent Living Resource Center of San Francisco, the organizational plaintiff in the lawsuit. He says there's no need for so many residents to live at the nursing home.
In the People's Republic of San Francisco, oddly enough, we incarcerate a greater percentage of our population at Laguna Honda than any other place in the country. There is only one reason why anybody ever needs to be in an institution, and that is because there are not yet appropriate community services for that person.
Laguna Honda's total annual budget is around $180 million. Recently, voters passed a massive bond to seismically retrofit and upgrade the facility. Protection and Advocacy staff attorney Elizabeth Zerker says the city's decision to invest more than $600 million in local funds to rebuild an outmoded institution and almost $50 million a year to operate it is not what people with disabilities want.
People with disabilities have the right to receive services in their community, and they shouldn't be forced into institutional care because San Francisco hasn't offered appropriate alternatives. People with disabilities prefer home and community-based services over nursing facilities, and it's also the law that people have the right to live in the most integrated settings.
San Francisco's own assessments show that some 80% of Laguna Honda residents could live in the community, yet the progressive members of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors support the rebuilding of Laguna Honda. Supervisor Chris Daly says the city needs to provide more beds in the nursing home, as well as more community-based residential programs.
One issue is whether consumers of mental health services, the frail elderly, have opportunities that are appropriate for them, whether they be in institution or in community-based facilities. The other is whether or not jobs and community-based programs are good union-type quality in terms of wages and benefits jobs. We can do both in San Francisco, and we should.
The plaintiffs say San Francisco officials oppose the downsizing or closing of Laguna Honda because they're concerned about what they perceive to be possible job losses by unionized workers at the facility. Again, Herb Levine.
The jobs issue is one of the things that prevents progressive legislators from acknowledging that this is a civil rights issue and that people belong where they want to be in their own homes. We want to move them into the community. We don't want to lose those jobs, and we're willing to work with the unions to try to make that happen.
Some disability rights activists say forcing hundreds of disabled people to live for decades at Laguna Honda is just as cruel as a prison sentence. Using his speech communicator, Mark Chambers expresses his wish to be free.
I am preparing to move out into the community, San Francisco. May hope to get into a home with my own room, but where I can be with other people. I hope to live in San Francisco again someday.
Attorneys and plaintiffs say they don't expect a settlement in the lawsuit anytime soon. I'm David Mandel, Free Speech Radio News, San Francisco.
And now, from his cell in Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal on the anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination.
This is Malcolm's meaning. The Malcolm X that we see represented in today's mass media is a Malcolm that Malcolm himself wouldn't recognize. He's portrayed today as a civil rights activist, a kind of Martin Luther King figure, except he was Muslim. In a sense, popular culture has softened his image and burnished his rawness. Malcolm wouldn't recognize this new Malcolm. To listen to Malcolm or to read his speeches is to find a man who was a revolutionary. He called himself a human rights activist because he had little trust that the U.S. government would fairly protect the rights of black folks. He He was a black nationalist who was also an internationalist, in essence, a pan-Africanist. During his years as a hard-working minister in the Nation of Islam, he was a bitter critic of civil rights leaders who struggled for integration. In his defense, he said, "It is not integration that Negroes in America want, it is human dignity." To be sure, integration was a means, not an end. And as we survey today's landscape broadly, we must admit that millions of black folks live in, or go to school in, communities and institutions that are economically and structurally segregated 40 years later. Malcolm moves many today because of his extraordinary integrity and his determination to learn, to grow, to develop. What touches many young people is Malcolm's rise from hustler and prisoner to minister and later spokesman for an emerging revolutionary movement. Malcolm had a tremendous impact on Huey P. Newton, founder of the Black Panther Party. In fact, Newton later wrote, he would have joined the Nation of Islam, except as the son of a preacher, he tired of religion. Many of us like to try to minimize Malcolm's years in prison. Yet these were truly formative years, which shaped him in ways that affected the rest of his life. Once, while in prison, Malcolm and other prisoner debaters held a debate against students of MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, on the issue of the death penalty. Malcolm was leader of the prison debating team and beat MIT by arguing that while English authorities were hanging people for stealing, English pickpockets were hard at work on the crowd stealing. His years of hard work and study while in prison prepared him for an extraordinary career as a minister and movement leader. It is precisely this role that made him a target of the state. One need only read Claiborne Carson's book, Malcolm X, The FBI File, published in 1991 by Carolyn Graff, to see how the FBI shadowed Malcolm X from place to place, from day to day, for years. They even record his trips abroad, like his lecture at Oxford Union, where he denounced U.S. domestic policy. The file showed Malcolm's speech earned long applause. But there is an even more foreboding memo. On February 21, 1965, the day of his assassination, the Malcolm X file reflects a conversation between a reporter for the now-defunct magazine Life and an unnamed person in Washington, D.C. During this conversation, one told the other that it was believed that Malcolm's killers were imported to New York from elsewhere. One person advised to the other that they should check out Washington and the CIA because Malcolm snafu'd U.S. relations with African nations. If anything, Malcolm X became a bigger presence in black life in death than before. It's been 42 years since his assassination. He's as alive today as he was on February 20th, 1965. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Tina Gysi and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.